ahead and take the speed up your number one now, runway 27 clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to the Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm one of the hosts of the show, Hal Bryan. I'm EAA's managing editor for print and digital content and publications. And for today's episode, we're doing something just a little bit different. Our chairman and CEO, Jack Pelton, sat down for a fascinating one-on-one conversation with a man named Francois LaSalle, who is the president and CEO of Vertical Aviation International. So for this episode, we're just going to turn it over to them and you get to listen in.
Welcome to this edition of EA's Green Dot. This is Jack Pelton, chairman and CEO of EA. And it's I'm taking the time to, because I think we have a very special guest, and I personally wanted to have a chance to interview and chat with the new president and CEO of the Vertical Aviation International Association, Francois LaSalle. Welcome. It's good to have you on the air.
Hey, Jack. Thank you, Jack. Yeah.
This year's a special year at AirVenture coming up because of your participation in our new EA Vertical Lift Center. Your organization has been integral, and actually, we have felt the personal connection of you embracing what we're trying to do here, which is really highlight and showcase more about what is happening in the world of vertical lift, which is what your association's all about. So, Thank you for your participation in helping that. We hope all the listeners that are out there coming to AirVenture will also come visit the Lift Center. It's got 26 exhibit spaces, and it's all things from helicopters to drones and eVTOLs, showcasing really the innovation and education and kind of industry recruitment. There'll be some static aircraft there also. So welcome, and look forward to seeing you in 19 days at AirVenture, and I think there'll be a lot for you to take on. Help me understand a little bit about your background, because I find it fascinating that you have been involved in the vertical lift area for so long, but also in so many different locations and places, which adds a new component to the leadership of this of your association.
Yeah, well, let me start by saying thank you for inviting me to join you on today's podcast. I think it's important that I take the opportunity to kind of quickly talk about what you've just mentioned, then I'll kind of jump into my background in a sec. But, EAA's commitment to vertical lift is important for us. The fact that you've got more space now, the fact that we've developed in partnership with the Robinson Helicopter Company and David Smith, the Center of Excellence, and vertical lift is really important, and it's an important part of the aviation industry of which I now represent, which I was super excited to join, by the way, because coming across here, VAI isn't just about helicopters. It's about everything vertical. It incorporates drones, advanced air mobility, and helicopters, and that now is a bigger cross-section of the industry, and that spans all the way from GA to Part 135 operations. And I think there's a wonderful future for the vertical lift market for us. So, and to be able to showcase that and bring that together in Oshkosh and AirVenture is going to be a big deal for us. So thank you for inviting us. Thank you for making that commitment and the support that you've brought for us to be able to achieve that. So a big deal for us in my perspective. Where do I start with my background? that's a good starting point. I think I've worked and operated all around the world, from Africa, Europe, Middle East, Southeast Asia, a little bit in South America and Latin America, and then obviously in the US. I've done a fair amount of time in the US as well, both in the military, in the Air Force, and then also in my civilian life. So, and I love it. The fact that I have such a broad scope of experience, I think, is why the board chose me to lead the organization. And that's really to put the international back into the eye of VAI. And my background spans all the way back to when I was a soldier in the South African Army, flying at the back of helicopters to go out into battle when, you know, we're still fighting the war in Angola in those days. And I was a soldier in a Zulu battalion, 1-to-1 battalion, because I learned how to speak Zulu growing up on the farm in South Africa. And so it was a prerequisite. I joined one of the Zulu commando units, 1-to-1 battalion, and was flown into combat in the back of helicopters. And I remember sitting there with my feet on the step with the doors open, going across the treetops, thinking this is so cool. And then being dropped off to get into a firefight and looking back at the pilot who was going back for a cold beer and considering my life choices at that point, going, yeah, I want that job. So this is a story that anybody who's heard a podcast from you before would have heard this story before, but I'm sorry to regale you with that story again. But it is an important introduction into my life in helicopters. And obviously leaving the South African Army and moving to the UK and working and getting into the Royal Air Force and flying both fixed wing and rotary in the Air Force, having flown in Special Forces with the SAS, VIP with the Royal Family and various other members, and support helicopter flying that I did in there in the Royal Air Force. And then jumping across into the airline world. So I've flown, you know, Boeing 757, 737, 787, 767s, Gulfstreams. I've flown a lot of stuff. But predominantly, the constant thread through my career has been safety and training. I've been a training examiner, instructor, type rating instructor, both in the rotorcraft world and the fixed wing world. So I'm passionate about training, but then also safety. So that's the sort of thread that runs through my whole career, whether I was fixed wing or rotorcraft. So I bring that broad experience, international experience and industry experience into VAI with a very clear mission statement of how to drive the association forward. So that's a little bit of a potted history for myself, Jack. There's a lot of other nuanced bits and pieces you probably want to dig into about my background, but that's a little potted history of how I've ended up here.
Well, as we continue to talk, I'm going to move over to help you get us grounded on a little bit of the history at EAA. For many, many years at Air Ventures, and specifically, is that there was the Helicopter Association was always a big exhibitor, and you guys undertook a rebranding. I wanted to make sure people understood that the Vertical Aviation International is actually a rebrand of what the Helicopter Association was, and share with us as to kind of that, what was that journey to this big rebrand?
So great question. And the answer to that is very simple. I think the board in the early 20s, so we had COVID in 2020, which we lost the show in 2021. We had our show in Anaheim in 2020, which was pretty good show. But then, of course, COVID struck us. And in 2023, the board elected to do a rebrand. Why? Because the emerging markets in both drone and advanced air mobility are racing forward very quickly. And I think the board wanted to remain relevant. I joined the board as the international advisor back in 2022. And it was imperative that we needed to adapt. I think it's, you know, history is littered with examples of organizations that don't adapt. Right. You can name a few. Kodak is one of them, for example. You know, if you don't adapt, you become irrelevant. And the board recognized the changing landscape with the emerging technologies and recognized it's not a dystopian future. It's a reality. Certification for some of these organizations are pretty close. They're doing an amazing job, by the way, and they've spent a lot of money on it. But it's a fascinating future. And it was one of the things that actually attracted me to this role, which was, you know, giving up running three organizations in Southeast Asia and living in Bali, which is where our central base was, and dragging my wife away from Bali to come here and do that. I'm still paying the price now. She's still kicking my ass now about it. But the beauty of it was the fact that I was very proud to be selected, very honored to be selected to run the organization in its new phase. So the reality is that helicopters are not going away at all, period. They're just not going away. It's just these new emerging technologies have a space in the vertical lift industry and community. And it's how do we prevent the individual siloed conversations going on each sector of our industry, whether it's drones, helicopters, or AM. And so the challenge to come across here was, you know, for me, exciting, because I now have an opportunity to represent a much larger cross-section of the industry. When you look at ICAO, FAA, EASA, most of the regulators, Transport Canada, CASA down in Australia, the emphasis has always been on the airline industry. You know that from, you know, from the GA world. A lot of the emphasis has been in the airline industry, and it's because they fly more passengers than anybody else. But one of the things that we as a vertical lift industry have not been stellar at, not been brilliant at, is selling ourselves. And, you know, how many barrels of oil we help to produce, how many lives we save, how many people we rescue hundreds of miles offshore, how many, you know, people we rescue with airmen on the side of the road, you know, how many towers we establish, how many power lines we help construct. I mean, it's endless. The work of vertical lift is endless. And the public doesn't know how much we do until that day you need an emergency helicopter, and then they realize, wow. You know, so for me, it was about bringing that community together, vertical lift, all vertical lifts, so AAM drones and helicopters, to sing with one credible voice, not the loudest, but the most credible. And I think what underpins that, Jack, is safety for me. You know, you will hear me say this often, safety is the currency of our credibility. And I mean that sincerely, because I think as an industry, if we can demonstrate to lawmakers and rulemakers, so law being Capitol Hill and in Europe, the European Union, and anywhere else, that we're taking responsibility for driving a safer industry, it helps us. It gives us the credibility and the legitimacy to go in and have those difficult conversations. But it also helps every sector of our industry. It doesn't matter whether you buy them, build them, lease them, manufacture them, design them, maintain them, train in them. We're all benefactors of a safer industry. So for me, it's combining all of that under our new brand, Vertical Aviation. So the transition from HAI to VAI, in my opinion, was essential. There obviously were some naysayers, you know, who said, oh, this is a fad and it's a waste of time and we don't know what you're doing. There's still some very vocal folks who I shan't name who do say that still. And while I get and understand that anxiety, I think there is a place for the new emerging technologies, and it's how we integrate that. We all fly in the same airspace. We all share the same DNA. It's how do we all coexist? And that's VAI's mission, is to try and bring that whole community together.
There's so many similarities and common issues that our two organizations are working. Your comments about safety for us, and especially when we talk about just our home building communities, the importance of safety, to your point, is if you aren't, you know, working on that every day and improving safety, your credibility and your ability to be able to attract people into this sector is very, very difficult. It's a tough selling point. And then, you know, the regulatory environment or the authorities, whether it be EASA or FAA, what have you, we always struggle getting general aviation as being a priority versus the airlines, as you mentioned. We were very fortunate in the last FAA reauthorization bill to have general aviation actually called out as a subset as opposed to just the airlines. Big win after all these years that they recognize us.
Thanks to Sam Graves, right?
Exactly, yeah. And on Saturday at the close of AirVenture, we're going to honor Sam. He'll be here recognizing he's not going to sit for re-election as a congressman, so.
Yeah,
we know he won't be helping us on the Hill directly. I'm sure he will be indirectly, but he will be a warbird enthusiast and attendee here for many more years to come. Question for you. When you talk about, you know, you really hit helicopters, drones, and the AM piece of it. Help me with the drone as to how do you guys see that really being integral and fitting in with you? I think we view, when we look at drones, the part of it that is so important to us is not necessarily about the function they serve and what is their market and what do they do, as much as it is, again, back to safety, to making sure that we can all integrate into the airspace adequately to be able to take advantage of these markets. So give me some of your insights around the drone's particular piece of it.
Yeah, I mean, where do you start? I mean, it's growing very rapidly. We're very fortunate to have Amazon come and join us now. We've had a lot of conversations with them. They like what we're talking about. We like what they're talking about in terms of airspace integration. The fact that this administration, and certainly under Duffy and Brian Bedford of the FAA, there's a big drive for the US to lead in that sector of the world, not only drones, but advanced air mobility. And there's a general recognition that, you know, we have to figure out a way in that we all coexist, particularly around congested airspace. So for those folks flying in congested airspace, it's got to be a key enabler to this being successful. And, you know, as you say, it's not about the functionality then, because whether it's moving your Amazon package or moving life-saving medical supplies through a drone or moving people on an advanced air mobility or flying an airman helicopter or an airliner all in the same airspace, it's how do we coexist in that airspace so we don't repeat the tragic accident in DCA of the Army helicopter. And that, you know, those events don't help us. So we're going through an evolution. This is an evolution. And these are major disruptors to aviation, the aviation industry. We accept that. We embrace that. But we want to move with the regulators and the government in this area, because we do embrace it. We just want to make sure that it's not done at the speed of government, which is traditionally really slow, but also not done at a pace that will break things. And so for us, when you talk about these things, two major factors, airspace integration and public trust, are imperative to their success. And I think they all know that now. I think a lot of the advanced air mobility folks, and if you look at what has been spent in the helicopter industry over the last 5 years in advancements in technology. So if you consider lower emissions, hybrid propulsion, lower noise, new blade design, crashworthy seating and helicopters and all those sorts of new designs, there's about $6.5 billion, roughly, order of magnitude, has been spent in the helicopter world. And that's tucked away in OEM budgets. When you look at the advanced air mobility world, and by the way, they don't like that name. We need to come up with another acronym for the guys, because I've polled every one of them like, no, we don't like that name, because it intimates the fact that they're a good PowerPoint presentation, they're not reality. So there's some stigma for them. So we need to kind of figure out a new name, which we'll poll them and try and get a new name. But in that world, over the same period, $28.5 billion has been spent by that community. And that $28.5 billion has opened a lot of doors for them. And so our role is to make sure that those conversations are joined up. The helicopter industry has nearly 100 years of lessons learned. And we felt that those stovepiped conversations were happening. You know, when I mean stovepipe, conversations in isolation were happening. So it's about how do we work with that market? Kate Clark, who was in government affairs before he was promoted to our EVP, was leading the charge on that with the AM folks. But what he was demonstrating is through evidence that VAI is the entity that is protecting the airspace for those very advanced air mobility and drone operators to be operating in that airspace. Nobody else is. That is our job. That's what we're doing. And we're doing it well. And we're punching above our weight on Capitol Hill to keep routes open, to keep heliports open, which we hope some of them can be transferred into vertiports with electrification and fire suppression and all the requirements that they're going to need. It's us. And I think that it kind of slowly started dawning upon them over the last few years, because some of these folks have been in development for a decade plus. And it's dawning upon them that VAI is the place for them to be and see as their home, so that they can kind of integrate in that vertical lift community. And then that VI will be able to lobby and have the hard conversations, both sides of the fence, right? Whether it's with the operators or with the regulators or on Capitol Hill, we're prepared to do that. But what drives us and what is going to drive us, particularly my strategy joining the organization, is data. So I would rather have a data-driven conversation than an anecdotally evidence-driven conversation, because that changes the dynamic.
You know, when you mention advanced the mobility, AAM, is there some confusion as to, and why maybe the naming nomenclature is confusing, is that they're right now the investments that they're making are really to create the next iteration of vehicles. I mean, the missions are going to be very similar as to what a helicopter is doing, and maybe people are looking at this saying, why is this different than a helicopter? Well, it's a different platform that it's more efficient and has all sorts of great attributes and features about it, but it is serving the markets that a helicopter serves today to accomplish those kinds of missions. But because the vehicle can do things that a helicopter cannot do economically and efficiently, like package deliveries to homes, as an example.
Yeah, and I think there traditionally has been, there've been so many acronyms since this all started, which was UAS, RPA, RPAS, UAM, AAM. I mean, there's been so many acronyms.
There has.
And everybody's everybody's confused. And if you want to get the folks that are developing, you know, the Beta and the Joby and the Eves and the Risks and all that sort of stuff, you get them upset, call it a drone. That'll get them upset.
I've seen the studies and literature and documents that groups have put together to try to explain and understand where these acronyms go and what they represent. And I think they're getting too focused on wanting to hold on to their acronym versus get rid of it and rethink what are we really trying to do collectively?
No, exactly. And I think, good Lord, in aviation, I mean, acronyms are a key feature of aviation, right? I mean, Boeing are probably the worst. I think I sat in so many Boeing meetings where I had no idea what was being said. And I've been in aviation a long time.
I started my career at Douglas Aircraft, which is, you know, a rival to Boeing. And I remember as a young engineer that they would hand you this book of acronyms. And the same acronym could be used for, you know, 20 different purposes. But they said, you know, here, young man, study these and make sure you can recognize and know what they are. And I remember going up to my boss. I thought I might have been a little cheeky on this one, was saying, so exactly what does an EO do? And so I was using it as an engineering order. And he looked at me. He'd been there about 30 years. And he said, well, it's that document you use to make design changes on. And I said, an engineering order, right? And he says, right. We've never called it that. It's always an EO. I thought, there we go. Welcome to the world of aviation.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I've been around long enough. I mean, even when I went from the airline world to the helicopter world in 2015, I came back to the rotorcraft world. And I thought, you know, I've been in the industry nearly 30 years. I can manage. I know what's going on. I sat in some helicopter meetings. No, I'm clueless. I don't know what you're talking about. It's just the acronyms are completely different from one sector of the industry to another. And so as I was saying, that most folks are designing aircraft. I mean, that's what they are. They are aircraft. The design philosophy is different.
Certainly.
How they function is different. But I often say we share the same DNA. One, we're aviators. Yes, they are technology-based companies who are probably slowly realizing, okay, we are really aviation companies. We should partner with those organizations that understand this industry and how to integrate into it and how to certify machines and how to maintain machines and how to train and how to fly safe operations. Those lessons have been learned. There's no point in relearning them. And I think a lot of them, you know, when you look at the likes of most of these AM manufacturers, as well as Amazon, right? They've got fixed wing and helicopter pilots as part of their program, as part of their design program. They've got engineers and maintainers from both fixed wing and helicopters in their design, development, and operational programs. So they're doing a great job, but it's the public who confuse it all, saying, "Well, they're all drones." They're not.
Which, by the way, Amazon is going to be one of the exhibitors at the Vertical Lift Center, so that will give people a chance to get to know what Amazon's roadmap and plan looks like.
Oh yeah, I encourage everybody to go and have a look at it. I don't know what location they'll be at. I'm hoping they'll be near where we're at, because we're at where's the Excellence Center?
Yeah, they're going to be in the Lift Center where you're at. Yeah, they're going to be in that.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Well, then I encourage everybody to go down and have a look at what they're doing. Next to the control tower, isn't it? So
yes.
Northwestern control tower. Yeah. Okay, that's perfect.
Circling back to this safety and the operation of, we all need to be able to use the airspace safely. My understanding is today there's been some letters that are being proposed, one from Amazon that's coming out in strong support of saying that both their vehicles and they need to have see and avoid capabilities that's important for the integration, which is dealing with the kind of the new proposed regulatory changes that will allow that to happen or not happen, that's being pressed pretty quickly. And I think it came out and fell a little flat because it didn't satisfy everybody's interest. As a matter of fact, I think it didn't satisfy anybody's interest. So there was major rewrites going involved in the beyond visual line of sight rules.
Yeah. There's a lot of work to still do in that area. And our plea with the FAA is we embrace the rulemaking that enhances safety, but we don't want it to be prescriptive, right? So so there's a couple of combinations to this, right? So there's the results of the accident just over a year ago at DCA. Obviously, there was a public outcry. There was a political outcry. There was a lot of moves to make something happen so it doesn't happen again. And then you've got Part 108, and then all the BV loss stuff around that. And so we're saying, well, look, can we take a performance-based regulation approach to this rather than be prescriptive about it? Right, everybody must have ADS-B in and out, and this is the widget that you must install to your aircraft, whether you're GA, a small organization or a large organization. That shouldn't apply equally depending on where you operate, what machines you operate. But integrating drones into that airspace, and this is what I like about Amazon's view on this, is that they see themselves as an aircraft. So the conspicuity for them is equally as important. It shouldn't just be a one-way, well, we'll have ADS-B in, and we'll just see and avoid you guys, and that's the end of it. You don't need to worry about anything else. And if you talk to David Smith, David, with Robinson, they're getting into the drone market, right?
Yes, they are.
They purchased a drone company. David will tell you, he said, we have these strengthened windshields to protect from bird strikes and the Robinson helicopters. And he said, that will protect you from a bird strike, but it will not protect you from a drone going through your windscreen. That will still go through it. Even a small 250-gram drone, and he held one up and demonstrated that at a listening session at the FAA. So it's about how we integrate that. And if you're operating, a power line inspection in the middle of nowhere, then do you need to have that? Is it applicable there? If you're doing firefighting, we know the data shows when you're doing firefighting over one of the areas like the Palisades where there was a horrendous fire, the amount of drone incursions was incredible. And the helicopters are trying to go in and out and put out fires. It's difficult when drones are unregulated and uncontrolled, just flying around. So we need to be a bit more coordinated about how we do it and have that conspicuity, because there's no ways as a pilot you can sit there and see a drone out the window. You'll just never see it. And whether you're flying a light fixed wing or a helicopter, the rules apply. I mean, you'll never see it. If you have something inside your aircraft that is a way of producing cost-effective ADS-B in and out, that if you've got an ability to give you that visual awareness, so you get your eyes out of the cockpit to try and find something, it's going to be helpful rather than just go, well, it'll be see and avoid and we'll be okay. There's a lot to this. Then that's what we're pressing the FAA for is, performance-based regulation.
I'm hoping that what we'll see out of this, as we've seen with the AAM guys, is that there'll be innovation. ADS-B's been in place for a while now, and I think people would argue that the initial specification for it was too stringent and as a result drove cost and made it more expensive than it needed to be.
Yeah.
Can we use this also as an opportunity of coming up with some newer solutions that do involve technology at a far lower cost, which gets more of us involved in embracing it as opposed to trying to fight it?
There's a couple of things to that, right? So yes and yes. Yes, there's got to be new technology, which we know exists with ACAS. And there's ACAS rotorcraft, there's ACAS for the airlines, there's ACAS for drones and AAM. So there's very specific, which is the advanced method of being able to take the controller out and plug it into AI modeling. And the reauthorization bill and the act as well pushing the ATC modernization and the $12.5 billion that's already been put forward to that is how you're going to do that. Because a controller can't physically control all of this. So we're going to have to be smart about it. But I come full circle back to performance-based regulation. Set the performance, work with industry to develop affordable technologies that can work to that. So for example, and then certify these things. Don't take forever to certify these things.
Right.
Because we know there are technologies out there that will help with situational awareness of other vehicles in your airspace, whether it's a drone, AM, a helicopter, or an airline. We can see each other in the airspace. Relying on the eyeball, Mark 1 eyeball, is probably not the best result. And we've seen some disasters as a result of that. So I think there is, but everybody's got to play their part in it. And I think that's where talking with the FAA and also on the Hill to help us have those conversations around, well, how do you just integrate that to say, well, you will all do this and you will all fit this equipment and it's all going to cost you $150,000 per aircraft to install it. Well, they're not all airliners that can do that, right? And we're not all big companies that can afford that. This country is so lucky. You're so blessed in this country with aviation. the freedoms that you have, the ability that you have to be able to fly, the affordability in this country. People that live in this country just don't understand how lucky they are. But we can't continue doing things the same way. We have to evolve because the airspace is going to become more congested. So it's a practical understanding from our side as operators and associations that we have to adapt the way we do our business right now. And then it's acceptance from government and regulators to sort of say, okay, well, let's take a pragmatic performance-based approach to how we integrate these new technologies into machines that are slightly older or emerging technologies that's actually affordable. So we don't run people out of business. That is absolutely not what we want. So yeah, I think there's a combination of things there. And that's where L1 VAI is kind of sitting in the middle of that conversation, trying to bring all the players to the table to have a joined up conversation.
Back to the innovation comment, I think that's why it's so important that the innovations that's coming out of AAM with the dollars that have been spent can be, they're going to be the leaders in providing new ways to certify, new ways to do the performance-based, and then some of the new technologies to that they are more fortunate to, I should say they have a better platform to do that in versus a conventional helicopter company that's regulated by all the current regulatory statutes that are in place that kind of tie your hands to a very costly and bureaucratic certification process. So I'm excited that, it's, you know, for a lot of our members ask, well, what do you think is going to come out of it? And I said, it's kind of going to be like the space blanket and the pen that went to an Apollo program. Is there's going to be innovation that will be low cost and be able to adapt into our normal GA aircraft and helicopters today?
I think in aviation, since day one, has been driven by, you know, economies and economies of scale, right? Yeah. It is ever the case. At the end of the day, you still need to sell them. You need to put people in them. You need to be able to carry loads with them. You need to be able to make money with them. And I think the economies will ultimately, I mean, GA is a little bit different because that, you know, that's a personal flying or a hobby and people have the financial ability to do that. And we don't want to remove those. We want to keep aviation alive. And as we continue to make it more bureaucratic, more rule-bound, more expensive, you know, the whole industry does suffer. So it's a fine balance between keeping it safe and applying new technologies and new rules, and that has to have a pragmatic approach to it. So I keep coming back to performance-based regulation is work with the industry to understand what question you're trying to answer. I mean, for goodness sakes, we're pursuing VAI. We're pursuing data aggressively. So we're investing in data. We're pursuing data aggressively. With the advent of technology, we've got, and we're bringing on board some experts to help us build this out with machine learning, AI, metadata, and the ability for us to look at data in a totally new, innovative way. And combining that with data from our operator community gives us a massively rich data field, which we can then support the regulators with that to sort of say, well, what question are you trying to answer in terms of safety, separation, conspicuity? Let's support you with the data to then come up with a performance-based regulation that says, well, here's the target we need you to hit. Here's the performance we need you to hit, and allow the industry to come up with a creative solution to achieving that rather than saying, well, you can go to Honeywell and buy this thing off the shelf and it's going to cost you $200,000. That's what we're going to do. And it's too difficult for us to look at certifying something else. That's not the answer, I think. So, that's where we want to work closely with the authorities, and our relationship with the FAA is so important to our success that it's not a them and us relationship. They are part of the community, and we're determined to work with them in a way that helps them develop their rulemaking, and we support some of the data because they've got massive data programs themselves. You know, the stuff that they're doing is incredible, so we want to be able to support that.
So I have a question that I don't want it to be a VAI answer. I want it to be Francois's answer on if you're going to answer the question as to which markets are going to be the markets that are going to be served first with the AAM development that's going on, how would you look at that roadmap as to how is it going to play out?
Wow, interesting question. So my take on it is there's multiple avenues to this because each AAM, so I've been to visit all of them since I've been here. I did a little bit of a roadshow and I went around the country. And I met with several of them. So I met with Eve, doing amazing work, and Eve are doing work that goes beyond just design and certification of an aircraft. It goes into the whole ecosystem and ATC and coordination and separation and integration. They've got a lot of work going on, and workforce development. So they've got a lot of work going on. So does Beta. So, and some of them are emphasizing different things. So if you go to WISC, for example, they are focused on autonomy. So no pilots in the front seat. Most of them are designing a vehicle around moving people. Beta's new design has not moved away from that, but shifted focus onto cargo first. So that roadmap to me looks like Francois's opinion, not VAI's position on this one. So my board doesn't slap me over the head with this. But my position is cargo will probably be a good starting point for these machines. Why? Because then you can test it. You can gain public trust and confidence. You can demonstrate and evidence integration and aircraft separation. So you can gauge that performance. And I think Beta have taken a really good approach to this. And they're sort of saying, look, yes, we are designing to be able to carry people, but we're going to make a start in the cargo area first. And I think that's where you'll see the progress of this developing is in cargo. They'll gain the time, they'll gain the trust, they'll gain the hours, they'll gain the data, and then be able to demonstrate moving in to moving people. Moving somebody from LaGuardia or JFK or, you know, Boston Hogan down to the town center is still on the agenda for them. It's the use case for that. You know, can it carry four people plus all their luggage?
Right.
That's a different question, right? It may not work like that out the gate. I don't think they can. The cost of microchips, the cost of building those batteries, and the life of the batteries under aviation regulations is totally different to a car. So, you know, the cost of those batteries is the majority of the cost of the aircraft. And so it's quite a complicated question to answer, but I see cargo is probably the natural starting point to gain that trust, then move that out into moving people around.
I have laid out my roadmap, which is very similar to yours, as I believe cargo is going to be the first step. And I think for a lot of reasons. One, there's a good pent-up demand and revenue that can source that comes with that. And I think from a risk profile, you know, endangering packages is a lot less than endangering human beings.
It's a lot easier to operate. I flew in DHL. Little side story. So I flew in DHL on the 757. I flew airline, you know, 121 flying passengers. And I'd always say when a passenger arrives at the airport, half their IQ, after check-in, half it again, because people get lost, they get drunk, they lose their passport, they fight on board. It's just, it was a nightmare flying passengers half the time. But when I flew cargo, boxers don't argue back. They're always on time. You only get paid when you deliver the box. You don't get the money up front. So, but I remember on my 757, when I flew 757, we had 15 ULDs. Those are the run-on containers that go down the back, right? Mm-hmm. So we had 15 of those. One of those containers, one, would pay for that whole operation that night, right? One. The other 14 were pure profit.
That's, yeah.
So when I look at these AM folks, I'm like, guys, you know where the money is? Cargo, moving cargo around. One night I arrived at the aircraft and you would normally get a NOTOC, notice to aircrew, about what you're carrying in the back. So dangerous goods or anything like that. So if you had a problem, you could tell ATC, I've got this load in the back. So you send the correct firefighting equipment and emergency services. I pitched up at the aircraft one night and I was flying out of East Midlands Airport. It's in the Midlands of the UK, and I was flying across to Brussels. And of course, the mint that was printing the new euro was in the UK. And I was sitting there and I didn't receive a NOTOC that night. And myself and you know, the pilot were sitting there. It's just the two of us. And a lot of cars with guys talking into their sleeves with, you know, earpieces and dark glasses on were surrounded the aircraft. And these trucks came in and with a high loader put these ULDs in the back. And I think it was the new 50 euro note that had just been printed that was going to be issued in Brussels, and we had a flight across to Brussels that night. I think I was carrying some ridiculous amount of money. It was in the billions of dollars. I had 25 something billion euro in the back of my aircraft that night. And I was like, my story's gone off track away from your question, but I was talking about, you know, the value of loads. And I looked at the other pilot that I said, hey, if we just turn heading 180 and keep flying, nobody's going to know, right? We'll go to some African countries or we land there and, you know, what do you think? So
Why do I think the part of your story that's also funny is the fact that they were printing the euros in the UK?
Yeah, I know. Ironic.
Very ironic.
Isn't it ironic? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, so cargo, I think cargo's got to be a winner. You know, like you said, you don't get the money until you get the load there.
So we're on your roadmap, because all the bookmakers are wanting to know whether they should pile all their money onto you. How does the autonomous fit in? Where does that come in the sequencing and timeline and particular missions that you see it fitting in?
Yeah, the autonomy piece, I think a lot of them, well, bar one, so WISC is planning to launch fully autonomous out the gate, whereas all the others went, no, we'll pilot first. So we'll have pilot first. And I think that's a sensible jump, because if you look at it, where we are today to that future of autonomy, there's a lot has to happen in the middle. Mm-hmm. And I think WISC understand that, and they know that. And I think they will probably look at how the other folks develop and transition with the pilots, because some of them will be moving to pilotless vehicles. So Beta, I don't know about the other ones, but I know Beta will do. The ultimate goal is to get to autonomy. And I liken it to the story of the Docklands Railway in London. That was going from City Airport, the new little airport in London, downtown city, the city center, and they built a new railway line. And it was an autonomous train back in the day. I can't remember when it was, years and years and years ago. And everybody refused to get on it.
Oh.
Nobody would get on it. They said, we're not stepping foot on this train unless there's a driver and a conductor. And so they're like, huh, okay, well, we've built it. So let's stick a driver and a conductor on it, which they did. And they sat in a seat. They sat in a passenger seat because there's no steering wheel or
sure.
There's nothing up front, right? So they had these people in uniform sitting on the train, and that built up enough public trust for people to get on the train. And they ran it for 2-3 years and then pulled the instructor and the driver out. And I think that mentality or approach, strategic approach, is what, you know, they're looking at. It's about building public trust. If you ask anybody in aviation today, hey, would you step onto an airliner without a pilot? I think generally people go no. But, you know, there's a lot of talk about those airliners becoming single pilot now and AI sitting in the other seat.
You know, I remember the transition from a lot of the airliners having flight engineer stations and, you know, eventually going to two pilots. And at Douglas, we had a cartoon up in the design office on the, actually it was a DC-10. And when we moved to the MD-11 to get rid of the flight engineer station and go to two pilot, and there was a cartoon that had the pilot, the co-pilot, and it had a dog dish with a dog sitting between the two of them. And it says, what's the dog doing in here? Just to make sure the two guys don't touch anything, because we're going full autonomous.
Exactly. So now it's going to be one pilot and an AI Rottweiler sitting in the other seat. That's going to slap you on the wrist if you try and touch anything.
Be able to take control. I mean,
yeah. I mean, God, goodness me. Look at the look at some of the Garmin systems now. You know those emergency systems that push one button to land? They're phenomenal. They've got them in helicopters now. So, I mean, I saw a demonstration of that. Now, that was eye-opening, you know.
Was that a Bell?
I think,
I had heard this. I had similarly, I had heard the same thing, that they could auto-rotate it completely by just pushing a button and letting it go.
Yeah.
Which.
Yeah, it's incredible what their one and their fixed wing will do. You just push a button, takes over, does ATC, flaps, gear, the whole caboodle.
Yeah.
Gets you on the ground.
That was probably the biggest breakthrough of the last couple of years from an aviation safety standpoint, in my mind, for general aviation. And it's, you know, the Garmin is quickly expanding its where it can be used in what airplanes.
Mm. It's incredible technology. You know, that and a ballistic chute.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at trying to purchase my own little airplane if I get time to go and fly it. But, you know, I mean, I've got years of experience with flying 35 years, and I'd still like to have a ballistic chute. I don't know why. You know, it's like, it's a nice little get-out clause, particularly if you're doing a water cross or anything like that, you know?
Francois, I have to be transparent and go on record, I hate those things, because I was at Cessna, those things clobbered us and killed us, because every time when Cirrus came out with their ballistic chute, they took so much market share from us because of customers that wanted that chute.
Everybody wants a parachute.
Yep.
A little get out clause. Yeah. Yeah. I just think, you know, I have a helicopter mindset, right? Which is, you know, the helicopter pilot mindset is, if it can go wrong, it will. And so when do you have to auto-rotate? When you're in the middle of the mountains or there's no clear area below you. You always assume the worst case scenario. But if I did purchase one, I'd have a little chute on it.
Did you start in helicopters in your flying career?
Yeah, I started the Royal Air Force fixed wing first, and I was when I joined the Royal Air Force, I came out of the Army and I went, I want to fly helicopters. And the Air Force went, are you mad? we're all about fast jets, dear boy. Yes, we have helicopters, but no, you don't want to do that. You want to go fly fast jets. So they sent me to the Harrier Squadron because I was flying fixed wing. It's your training's fixed wing in the Royal Air Force. You don't go straight to aircraft. It's helicopters.
Did you fly the Hawk?
The Harrier. You know, I went to flew the Harrier. I held on the Harrier Squadron for a couple of years, and I flew the Harrier for a while. And then I was kicking and screaming to go helicopters.
Is the Hawk on the step up to the Harrier? The
BA correct. Hawk? Yeah, it's the trainer.
It's
the trainer. Yeah. So what back in the day, the Air Force would say, because there was a glut in the training system, so you would hold for a period between going from one aircraft to another aircraft. So I did my elementary flying training, basic flying training. And at that point, they will stream you to go helicopters, multi-engine, or fast jets. And I said, I want to go helicopters. And they were like, no, you're crazy. You got to go and fly fast jets. And the next course would be the Hawk course, to go and do the Hawk trainer. But I had 2 years holding. So they said, well, we'll send you to go and fly Harriers for 2 years. You hold on the squadron, you can go and fly in the two-seat Harrier. Go and fly that for 2 years, and we'll indoctrinate you and get you out of this mindset and want to fly a contraption, a thrashing palm tree. Go and fly jets for a couple of years. And I did. I mean, I loved it, but I still wanted to go and fly helicopters. So at the end of that, they went, all right, okay, we'll send you helicopters. And so I was sent across to go and fly helicopters at that point. So I flew both. And I initially the Gazelle, because every Harrier pilot has to go and fly the Gazelle for 10 hours back then.
Interesting.
You have to learn how to hover. Yeah. Mm. You have to learn how to hover, just the references for hovering. And then I flew the Gazelle, then the Wessex Mark II. And then I was fortunate to be posted to the Puma Squadron.
Oh, okay. We are very excited this year at Air Venture to have the Royal Air Force's Red Arrows performing for the first time ever. And so some of the folks on this side of the pond who have never seen them perform are going to be in for, I think, quite a treat.
That is a special event. For those that haven't seen it, please be there when it does happen. And of course, I'm biased. I'm Royal Air Force. So I'd say it is the best aerobatics team in the world. some would differ. I think, some way to the Blue Angels probably differ, but...
Don't forget the Thunderbirds. Don't forget our Air Force boys. Yeah.
I'm Air Force. I should be loyal to the Air Force. The Thunderbirds are pretty awesome with the F-16 too, but the Little Hawk is pretty good. And I think they're flying one down, so it's are they one less than they normally are?
They're going to fly 7, not 9. I think they have. Yeah. I think that they're at that point where with the airplanes getting a little bit older, they're holding 2 back in case they need a spare. But they'll have 9 over here.
Yeah, it's still impressive nonetheless. I mean, the Hawk is nowhere near as impressive as the Blue Angels or the Thunderbirds, but the flying is pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's...
So I'm really glad to hear that they're going to be there.
Yeah, they'll be performing Thursday through Sunday, so arriving on Thursday, I believe, is the schedule today.
Oh, fantastic.
I have taken a lot of your time, and with great appreciation for you to give your insights as to what the vertical... Aviation International is all about and what you're seeing in those market segments. It's incredibly educational. I've thoroughly enjoyed it and learned a lot. And I'm certainly pleased that you're at the helm of the organization. They've had a great history and you're going to take it into the places that it's kind of just the next real evolution of where this is all going. I think you're going to have a lot of fun being in the, I guess in your line of work, it'd be the right seat, not the left seat.
I'm one of the few ambidextrous guys, right? I've flown both seats, fixed wing and rotorcraft. But it's Jack, thank you very much for having me on. I am so excited to be there, and 35 years in the industry, this is my first time. So Rob promised to give me a VIP tour, so I hope to get to go around and have a look at everything.
I look forward to spending some time with you, and thank you for your leadership in encouraging us to really grow this Vertical Lift Center, and we hope this is the start of a big program over the next few years to make this a more important focal point at Air Venture.
Yeah, it's going to be spectacular. So I'm dying to get up there and come and spend some more time with you. And I think I promised you a beer, so we'll go for a beer. But I'm looking forward to it. Thank you for having me on today and allowing me to flap my gums for an hour with you and your listeners.
Well, thank you. And this has been a really special edition of Green Dot. And we look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks. And thank you to all of our Green Dot listeners at EA. So I'm going to sign off.
Thanks, Jack.
Our thanks again to Jack and Francois for taking the time to have that conversation and share it with everybody as an episode of the Green Dot. Thanks, of course, to everyone out there for listening, especially those of you that take the time to go to Apple Podcasts or Amazon or Google or anywhere you get your podcasts and you leave us a review. That means a lot, and that positive feedback that we get is really the reason we're able to continue doing this show. Speaking of which, you can also email us, feedback@eaa.org. If you've got any thoughts about any episodes we do or suggestions for future episodes, anything like that, that email will eventually find its way to us. And if you go to inspire.eaa.org, which is our hangar flying blog, every episode has a landing page there, and there is a section there to leave comments as well. And we look at those things. We take them very, very seriously. So with our thanks once again to all of you for listening, we look forward to catching up to you next time when you're cleared to land on the Green Dot.